Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
We come to you not from Catherine's back garden, which was the plan, but a rainstorm has erupted, which has made Matt and myself just sit in the car for about 10 minutes until it stopped. So we are in Catherine's living room. It's lovely.
It's very convenient for me.
Yes. And we're ahead of the US Open, Matt. This couldn't be less like the US Open if it tried, could it, this particular room?
What are you trying to say about my living room?
Well, there's no, I can't smell any burgers, and I can't, and the lifts are working, so it's nothing like the US Open, and there's no loud people around.
It's temperate.
Yes, it's temperate. There's no humidity.
No.
So, for six
but
days
But there's also
time,
no buzz.
No, that's, well, we're providing the buzz. Okay. Here on the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. How are we all doing, folks? We've had Cincinnati. We've had Madison Keys winning the title over Svetlana Kuznetsova. We've had Daniil Medvedev beating everybody in the world several times over. And after two consecutive finals, winning the title in Cincinnati, he has been amazing. How are we all doing?
We're doing all right. I've sort of got over my Montreal jet lag just in time to go to New York, so... Brilliant.
You're not really planning that out, but there we are. And how about you, Matt?
I'm well. I've just about dried off after getting drenched a minute ago. David came to my rescue.
It was unfortunate timing.
I was walking along the street and suddenly David's car was there and the next moment I was in it and dry.
Dripping all over my car. That's fine.
It's like the start of a film, isn't it?
Yes. Well, these are the lengths we go to for you here on the Tennis Podcast. Thanks for joining us. We've got lots to talk about today, so let's get cracking on with it. We've got the US Open coming up in just a few days' time. As Catherine says, she's swapping this lovely, serene setting for the buzz, the razzmatazz of Flushing Meadows in New York. When are you going? 2 days' time?
I go in 2 days' time, yeah.
Right, okay. So Catherine's going on Wednesday. I'll be there at the weekend. Matt's not coming. Sorry, Matt.
Serious FOMO.
But next year, the goal is, with the Kickstarter crowdfunding, is to get Matt to New York with us here on the Tennis
How
Podcast.
How on earth are we supposed to create buzz with no Matt?
I don't know. How are we supposed to do anything these days? We've become so over-reliant.
Genuinely worried about it.
We don't do any research anymore at all. We just expect to know stuff, courtesy of Matt. There's so much to get through today. We've also obviously had our Andy Murray show. We'll get Catherine's reaction to that because Matt and I were talking about that on Monday's show. And we've got my big interview to preview, which is going out on Wednesday. I'll tell you at the end of the show who it's with. So first of all, Cincinnati, men's and women's tournaments. Let's start with the women's tournament, which has resulted in two more additions to the mix.
Right. Was Madison Keys not already in the mix?
No way. Was she?
I think she's always in the mix at majors, isn't she? She's Major Keys.
Haven't you got to win one first? I mean, or at least be winning stuff on the way.
There are people that haven't won slams that are in the mix. In the women's, anyway. Possibly in the men's, more to come.
Interesting.
This is a dangerous place to start, I think.
It is a bit. But, I mean, look, let's move on from the mix.
I think Madison Keys is always in the mix at majors.
Okay.
Especially New York, where final, semi-final.
Absolutely.
Her run to the title is just... extraordinary. First round, Garbiñe Muguruza, Daria Kasatkina, Simona Halep, Venus Williams, Sofia Kenin, and then Svetlana Kuznetsova.
And she hit, I think it was at 4-5 in the second set. The stat swooshed up that she had hit 40 winners in that final, in the two sets of that final against Svetlana Kuznetsova. So it probably ended on at close to 50. And she was not making errors. Mm. I mean, quite obviously, if she plays like that, she is in with a very good shout of winning the US Open. That's obviously just a massive, massive if. But that's as good as I've seen Madison Keys play.
Why,
for sure.
Why is that? Because we've always known she's spectacular. She's an incredible ball striker. But there was something different about her on the way to... I mean, look, it was her biggest title for a start. So clearly there's something different. But even the way she was going about doing it was different. It wasn't just like having a great week and it all clicking and she just played lights out tennis, was it?
I think it was the shoes, maybe, the source of all her powers. They were really great trainers.
I was definitely going to say it was the footwork. So that links in with the shoes.
They were, why aren't trainers, it's made me think, it's made me spiral in thought about why trainers aren't snazzier in tennis.
And I mean, you may be thinking, what has happened to this podcast? Suddenly we're talking about the shoes when we should be talking about the players. The reason this is particularly momentous is because Catherine is so anti talking about player clothing that this is quite a moment for me. I remember us doing
an entire
show. Well,
only because of how laced and with all the things and how gendered generally discussion of player clothing is. Not because I'm not interested in clothing or because I think it's bad to be interested in clothing, but just because it's a difficult one to get into and avoid and sidestep all of those pitfalls. But I really loved Madison Keys's snazzy leopard print trainers, and I urge there to be more snazzy trainers in tennis on men and women.
Right. Okay. Well, just to say, if you go back in the archives about 7 years to when we were just trying to work out how to do this show, I did want to do a special on tennis player clothing, and I did. And Catherine put up with it. And I described the Jim Courier shirt of 1992 that I used to own and wear proudly with its baseball stripes. But Catherine was not interested.
Things have got more interesting now, though. They've, you know, started dressing Kana Shikori as a licorice all sort. Think that, you know, in the 90s it was just baggy white top t-shirt with NAF
trim
pattern. Slash logo.
Okay. So
off you go.
Moving on from Madison Keys' shoes, what were your observations, Matt? Because I remember seeing a tweet from you that summed it up pretty neatly for me, that we were seeing something from her that we just haven't seen really, certainly not consistently before.
Yeah, I think the tweet was, when has she been this disciplined? Because Madison Keys has always been capable of hitting winners, but she's not always had the consistency, and I was trying to figure out what had changed. And I did think it was the footwork. She was in the right place to hit the right shot. It's almost a little bit Stan Wawrinka-like when he was coming back from his injury. He still had all that power, but he wasn't in the right place to hit the ball because his footwork wasn't right. He still wasn't trusting his leg, and his shots were going all over the place. Keys hasn't had that kind of injury, but she just seems to have improved her footwork. It was great to watch because she lost none of what made her Madison Keys, which was the firepower and the ability to hit winners. We said about 50 in the final. I think she'd hit 70 across the quarters and semis put together. And yet she was rallying from the baseline, being patient, playing with margin. And those things together are going to make her really tough to stop. I mean, as we saw in Cincinnati, and I think we will see it in New York as well. If she plays like that, good luck beating Madison Keys when she's playing like that, I think.
Yeah. The thing is, I feel like probably several coaches have tried to get her to play like this, including Lindsay Davenport. And if you look at the sheer number of coaches she's had, it's
a lot.
Pretty mind-boggling. And she's had 6 to 8 coaches.
And she's gone back now to the coach she had, I think, when she won Eastbourne in 2014, which is kind of her breakthrough result. I think she's back with him. I think he's called Juan.
Juan Todero.
Yeah, that's right. And I think she said that, yeah, as you said, lots of people have told her that she needs to be more disciplined and play with more margin, but she's realised it for herself now. And that's almost more powerful than someone telling you to do it. You have to believe it yourself, and she knows it now.
But she also has to trust her legs, doesn't she, in order to have that base, to be able to keep getting to these balls. Not because a lot of her tennis became panic tennis. Right, I can't, I'm not winning the point, I've got to hit a winner, a bailout of a rally. But you mentioned Juan Todaro. I didn't realise that he used to coach her before. I remembered his name, and I couldn't work out where from, so I looked up all of his players he'd coached, and she was one of them. And I realised that I commentated on that final, that Eastbourne final for BT Sport back in the day. And that is when she was at her most impressive in my recollection. She, at that time, is when you interviewed Brad Gilbert, Catherine, shortly afterwards, because that was in 2014, Eastbourne. Catherine
tackled him on his feud with David Law.
And blocked David Andrews.
You got him to unblock me, so thanks for that. But you got him on Madison Keys, and you got him saying that she will be world number one inside 72 months. No, that can't be right.
No.
Inside 2.5 years. How many is that?
30 months.
Yeah. I'm not very good at the maths, folks. So, yeah, basically inside 2.5 years. 2 months. What am I talking about? It's like 6 years.
So, what a weird number to pluck.
I was thinking about 72 holes because I was listening to the No Laying Up Golf podcast on the way down here. Anyway, shout out to them if they're listening. I'm sure they're not. But yeah, Brad Gilbert said that she will be world number one inside 2.5 years. Martina Navratilova, I then interviewed a few months later, who said, I don't even think it'll take that long. So we weren't doing them any favours in terms of like just quenching the hype here. We were building it up here on the Tennis Podcast. That was mid-2015. Here we are 4.5 years later, and she hasn't got near that. She's reached one Grand Slam final at the US Open. She didn't really come close to winning it. Sloane Stephens won it. But she has, as you said, kept knocking at the door at the Slams. But it still feels underwhelming based on that 19-year-old I saw in Eastbourne.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, she's going to be, well, as of this moment, she is number 10 in the world. And I think the seedings for the US Open are done based on the rankings today. So, I mean, she's not going to be one of the top 8 seeds. So that is a danger for other seeded players, I would say. But she shouldn't be number 10 in the world, should she? I mean, she's behind Aryna Sabalenka at number 9. That's surprising. Anyway.
She's just starting to play well again, Sabalenka, by the way.
Yes.
But still, you know.
It's taken a while.
I think her ranking has stayed quite high, hasn't it? Because a lot of what she achieved last year was the back end of the year, and those points haven't fallen off.
She won Wuhan, didn't she?
She will tumble unless she continues in the direction, as you say, Dave, she's been in the last couple of weeks. But anyway, Madison Keys. Yeah, I think there's maybe been a bit of, I'm possibly putting words in her mouth, but a bit of sort of fatalism and determinism about her attitude towards her own game over the last few years. You know, I'm just a big hitter. You know, movement's never going to be my forte. These are the things I do well. I've just got to stick with them and believe in them, rather than thinking, maybe I can be something a bit different. Maybe my game can be a bit more malleable. Maybe movement doesn't have to be a big weakness for me. And it does feel like something is clicked internally for her, rather than people telling her how they ought to be. And
injuries kept derailing her as well.
Wrist injuries, didn't she?
And she also had the adductor injury at the Australian Open about 3 years ago, when she was almost carried off the court. You know?
And I think the US Open final a couple of years ago did probably scar her for a while. You know, she froze on that occasion. She was playing a fellow first-time Grand Slam finalist. You know, they were both in the same boat, both good friends, and to have all of those parallels going in, and then for them to have dealt with that so very differently on the day, I can imagine that would make you feel very insecure and insufficient somehow. Why was she able to deal with that and not me? I imagine that probably did bring with it some baggage that it's taken a while to get over.
I would have one reservation, having watched the final against Kuznetsova, and we've talked about how a lot of her confidence is coming from within now, and she seems to be understanding her game a lot better. However, in that final, she wasn't reliant on on-court coaching, but she did lean on it quite heavily. She was trailing in both sets to Kuznetsova. Kuznetsova served for both sets. She certainly led 5-3 in both sets, Kuznetsova. And Keys called on Juan Todera quite key times. And he was basically saying, you've got to start taking the ball a bit earlier and hitting it at the top of the bounce. And she did exactly that both times. She responded to him coming on. So I hope that she'll be able to transition to playing in New York without having that guidance of on-court coaching. But we have seen, certainly the player that comes to mind most is Pliskova, who's had all these great results on the WTA Tour and not been able to transfer it to a slam. So that would be my one reservation.
Plus, she can throw in a horror of a performance every now and again, can't she? She can look like she's going somewhere in a slam and then just throw in an awful performance.
So Evgenia Rodina at Wimbledon last year, that match will live with me for a long time. How somebody that good can play that badly, is mind-boggling.
Yeah. The woman she beat, Svetlana Kuznetsova, in the final, is kind of the opposite in that she's a hugely talented player. I was looking back on 2007 when Roger Federer described her as one of his favourite players. He said, I really like her game. And that was when she'd already won the US Open title in 2004. It's going to be 15 years since she won that US Open this year. I'll commentate on that as well. Let's see how old I am.
That was the year that I first went to the US Open as a fan.
Yeah.
The year that Kuznetsova won.
She would have been 18 at the time. It's a great longevity from her. And here, was it a wrist injury she's had over the last couple of years? Because she's been in a terrible way. I remember when she qualified for the WTA Finals, knocking out Joe Konta 3 years ago. It was right at the last minute. She was playing the most wonderful stuff. And then I thought she would probably win a slam the following year at some point, and then eventually she got struck down by this injury, and I thought she might be done at that age, and this week she's beaten Sevastova, Yastremska, saving two match points, Sloane Stephens, Karolina Pliskova from 3-6, 3-5 down, and then Ash Barty in the semis to get to the final. Fantastic.
Yeah, I found it really uplifting seeing what she was doing this week. I have to say, I thought she probably was done. I remember, we follow her on Instagram, don't we? And sort of her Instagram over the past 6 months has not looked like, I know this is falling into the trap of assuming that what you're seeing on social media is 100% of the person and what they're doing with their lives, whereas actually it's the best 1% or the most glamorous 1%. But it didn't look like she was on her way back to becoming a professional tennis player again. It looked like somebody that was just enjoying life away from tennis. So I'd kind of framed her out of my thoughts of current tennis. And then here she suddenly is, being brilliant. And we were watching in the Prime Video Studios, we were obviously covering the men's event in Cincinnati, but myself, Daniela and Greg were watching bits and bobs of the women's in the studio, and they were just, they were reminiscing really about how they used to think and talk about Kuznetsova when she first broke onto the scene in the mid-noughties, and they both agreed that she had and has absolutely everything. They both said, well, she should have been number one, she's just bags of talent, wonderful ball striker. They're just glorying in her game. And it's hard to think of her as an underachiever because she's a two-time Grand Slam champion, but it's possible that she could have been an awful lot more than that. And maybe that's what's driving her on to make this comeback, because she looks a fearsome prospect. And it took something as spectacular as Madison Keys to take her out yesterday.
And I think a lot of people who've followed her career really closely were saying that this is the fittest and leanest she's almost ever looked. I was watching back some of that 2004 run to the US Open title, and what struck me then is how then she seemed really, really powerful. She had this huge forehand, which she still has a big forehand, but it doesn't seem quite as big in comparison to a lot of the players today. Like, for example, Madison Keys had the power advantage in that final. But Kuznetsova, even though she's 34, has managed to figure out ways to sort of stick around in points and use movement and fitness as a strength. And you don't often see that from a 34-year-old. And actually, I was looking at some of the numbers, and she was really bucking the trend if she'd won this title, because so many of, well, all of the big events on the WTA Tour this year have been won by players less than 30. The oldest winner of a what you'd call a big event, the premier events and the slams, is Petra Kvitova, 29, and Andreescu, the youngest, at 18 in Indian Wells, and the average age is 24. And so Kuznetsova's 10 years older than that average age, and yet wow, she didn't look or feel out of place because her tennis was so good. And obviously it's just interesting to compare that to the men. I haven't crunched the numbers for the men, but I imagine the average with Federer, Nadal and Djokovic winning so many is up in the 30s. But so she's managing to compete with people 10 years younger than her, which I just think shows the strength, the natural talent that she still has in her game.
And actually that forehand of hers, she hits with a heck of a lot of spin.
It does.
It's one of those that you think is going out a lot of the time. Yeah. You could imagine a line umpire's calling it out and then suddenly it just drops. It'd be great if she could have a run at the US Open.
And she's also had this amazing, well, quite sort of sad story really, in that she was denied her US visa for so long. It meant she couldn't defend her Washington title.
Yeah.
And she put it out on Twitter, which I think was quite smart, because didn't the US embassy or something get involved and said, right,
yeah,
we're going to...
I think so. And she was asked, what's been the key to you playing so well this week in Cincinnati? And she said, well, getting my visa.
Yeah.
It doesn't half help, does it?
Yeah.
She so many sort of nice touches like that to the story of Svetlana Kuznetsova this week. I mean, her press conferences and interviews are and always have been an absolute joy, haven't they? And people have been sort of posting some of her best bits from the last, 15 years on tour on Twitter. And also she thanked Daria Kazatkina in her speech yesterday because Kazatkina lent her coach for the week.
Carlos Martinez, I think he's called. And he's just started coaching Kazatkina. Svetlana, because Kuznetsova was like, well, I need a coach. So they're kind of coach-sharing him for the week.
Yeah, and she said, thank you, Dasha, or whatever it is, you know why.
Well, I think he was her coach for a long time, wasn't he?
Yeah. And they communicate in Spanish. She's completely fluent in Spanish. And she's also renamed Finding Nemo. Did you see that?
Yes, Looking for Nemo.
Looking for Nemo. Because she says she has a memory like Dory and that she forgets
things.
She
can't remember the name of Finding Nemo. Yeah.
I will forever be calling it Looking for Nemo from now on, I think.
I mean, this might not work in podcast form, but somebody tweeted a transcript from an interview she did a little while ago during Wimbledon, actually, this year. And she's just so fantastically honest. She said, when are you happiest? She said, when I win matches and when I'm close to people I love and my dog. Great. Top-notch answer, Sveta. Is there something you wouldn't mind being woken up for in the middle of the night? An emergency. Then the interviewer says, other people told me they don't mind waking up for Federer and Nadal match. I said what I said. So good. She's great. She's great value, and it's great to have her back.
She prioritises dogs and sleep.
Yeah.
Sounds like
kindred spirits over here.
All the good things.
Right. Okay. So that's the final of the women's tournament. What else have we had? In the men's tournament, we had Daniil Medvedev finally winning it. He got to the final of Washington and lost to Kyrgios. More of him later. He got to the final of Montreal and he lost to Rafael Nadal, who didn't play Cincinnati. And then you had this run for Medvedev in Cincinnati, where you're wondering whether he's going to be on fumes. Is he going to have nothing left? You talked about him last week, didn't you? About you'd been there on finals day, and there was never a sort of flicker of a suggestion that he wasn't going to go to Cincinnati or that he might be too tired for it or whatever. And if we fast forward, he gets through to face Novak Djokovic. Now, I saw the first point of this match and I thought Djokovic just looks in the most perfect form. Even just in the first point, everything was coming out of the centre of the strings. And he went 6-3 up, three games all, love 30 on Medvedev's serve. By this time, I was asleep. I couldn't stay up that late because, you know, I need my beauty sleep.
David Law's experiencing school holidays, yes. Folks.
Yeah, it's quite tiring, isn't it? And then I wake and just watch it back and I saw something in Medvedev I've never seen before. Now, he says he's done this throughout his career. If he's not winning by going toe-to-toe, playing his consistent brand of tennis, then he will serve first and second serves with a first serve and just go for it. Now, I'd never really noticed that before until this match. And at love 30, he suddenly starts bombing down 125-mile-an-hour second serves like Kyrgios or Philippoussis would and making them. And he just ripped the match out of Djokovic's hands.
Well, as Djokovic put it, he played roulette and he won, which I think, I mean, it's not necessarily wrong. I think there's more to it than that. It was a fantastically astute tactical change, and actually I don't understand why that tactic is not deployed more often. If you're being crushed on your second serve, what is there to lose by going for it? You know, if your stats are sort of, I think he was at 35% points won on the second serve, and if you're serving first serve percentage higher than that, it's a no-brainer, surely. And I asked Daniela about it, and she said, it's just courage. She said, quite often that thought will cross your mind as a player, and you'll think, that's probably the smart thing to do. And it's just so counter to everything your muscle memory is telling you to do that you just can't quite bring yourself to actually action it. But not Daniil Medvedev. He's got real character, hasn't he? He's got so much about him that's good. And that's his signature move now, isn't it? Nick Kyrgios has the ask people. I mean, he's got other signature moves, of which more to come. Nick Kyrgios has got the ask people in the crowd where I should serve, and Medvedev's got the 120-mile, 5-mile-per-hour second serve ace. It's great. Love it.
I think the danger with that tactic is that it could get even worse. Like, if you start missing your second serves at 130 miles an hour, it's going to go downhill extremely quickly, and you're going to almost look a bit like you're tanking in a way if you're just doing that and getting it wrong. But to have the courage to do it and get it so right was what I thought was so impressive. But it did kind of leave me thinking, and that phrase from Djokovic, he played roulette and he won, Djokovic would back himself to play his style of tennis and perform at a high level over five sets. And he will also trust that Medvedev can't keep that up over five sets. And that's almost what the big three have done. They take you out of your comfort zone.
And
they force you to play a way which is high risk. And
let's not forget, though, Djokovic has also got his own other gear, his own roulette wheel.
He didn't have it on Saturday.
No, he doesn't.
He saves it now.
But think about it. When he's backed into a corner, Djokovic, is when he often will shock you. Mm. You don't see it coming. He does.
Absolutely.
Have another level.
And I agree with everything you're saying.
Federer.
And I think that's why he didn't sound too concerned by the loss on Saturday night. He just sort of shrugged it off and said, I mean, the subtext seemed to be, good luck doing that over five sets, buddy. He was very accepting of it, really, considering how, you know, Simon Reed described it in commentary. He said he's been mugged. And that is how it felt. He was absolutely sublime, Djokovic, in total control. Medvedev wasn't playing badly. He was just not able to get close to the world number one playing in his absolute pomp. Medvedev calls the trainer, then receives some treatment for what Hannah Wilkes on Twitter described as acute lack of bicep, which is my favourite thing ever.
It was amazing. Like he, like the trainer literally touched his arm and he went, ow, ow.
Which is exactly what I would have done.
Yeah.
Regardless.
Also,
when it hurt or not.
Also made me ponder on how rare a bicep injury is in tennis. Never see people get bicep treatment. Anyway, so there he is getting a light prod to his bicep, not enjoying it at all. And then suddenly everything changes. So I can't remember what my original point was. I'm just thinking about whether I can think of any other bicep injuries. Anyone ever had a bicep injury?
I haven't had one myself.
I don't know if that's because it's a particularly robust part of the body or whether it's because it's not a particularly significant part of the body for tennis.
I also suffer from the acute lack of.
Same, yeah.
He said after the match that he was finding that, again, it was a big talking point over the US Open series, the heaviness of the balls was what was provoking the problems with his arms. Rafa wasn't happy with the heaviness of the balls. In
Djokovic had got an elbow issue, hadn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Everyone is really unhappy with the balls that are used at the during the US Open series, and they're, of course, different balls to the Wilson ones that are used at the US Open.
That's just plain weird,
isn't it? It is weird, isn't it? And it's this, I believe it's a deal that's been done, but you can understand the players not being happy.
And I think I'm right in saying it's changing next year.
Is it? Okay, great.
So I think they're going to be, there's going to be consistency of balls during the US Open series then at the US Open. But it does seem like, I mean, obviously we're all kind of outsiders in terms of tennis ball. Tennis ball is a tennis ball, but they're not. But it does seem madness that they don't use the same ones kind of throughout the year, really, let alone throughout a little swing like that.
Yeah, and if, you know, pundits and players seem pretty much in consensus that it's a fairly significant factor, and it is a big caveat when you're trying to analyse form and favourites and people that may or may not be in the mix going into the US Open. You know, when we were trying to discuss that in the Prime studio, every time Greg would say, yeah, but remember the balls are different, and that's a big thing, particularly if the conditions, the heat and humidity become a factor. So it's annoying.
There was a mad moment in the women's final where they played a game with the men's balls. Because the men and the women have different balls, and they got new balls, and they played a game with the wrong ones. And Keys, I don't think Keys noticed. And then it went down the other end for Kuznetsova to serve, and she was like, these are the wrong ones. Keys was like, goodness. Oh, well, that was why I missed.
Oh, dear.
That's bizarre. And there was a delay to the men's final because the net, they couldn't find, that there was a broken net.
Yeah. Superb filling, by the way. You got through that really well.
Oh, players are in the corridor. They're raring to go. Oh, players are going back into the locker room.
Let's have a chat.
What are they doing? let's talk about tennis.
So I've run a pole vault. You'll be pleased to know. And the pole vault is, who do you expect will have the better US Open? Roger Federer or Daniel Medvedev?
Well, I asked this of the pundits in the Prime studio because Greg Rozetsky went big on Federer-related US Open predictions. He went big early. Of course, Federer won one match in Cincinnati against Juan Londero, looked okay, looked as good as he needed to be, then lost his second match to Andrei Rublev. Brilliant. Andre Rublev, it has to be said, and he's had a tough time, and I'm pleased to see him on the way back. But it was his quickest loss, 62 minutes, since 2003.
Yeah, Sydney 2003.
Which is an extraordinary stat. So I asked Greg, is Roger Federer in the mix for the US Open?
You notice the way she started, you know, branching the mix out to other outlets. Just
casually drop it in now.
Hey, it works as a punditry device because Punchy Greg said no. Roger Federer not in the mix. He asked for clarification of the mix. He said, in the mix to reach the semi-finals. Yes, I said, no, Greg. The mix. The mix equals win the title, and he said no.
We still haven't got an official
definition. Yesterday, when pressed further on the mix, and I asked him whether Medvedev was in it, and he said a tentative yes.
Okay, then. So I've asked you two. What do you think?
Is Medvedev in the
mix?
No,
I'm asking you, who is going to have the better US Open out of Roger Federer and Daniil Medvedev? I've got results. 600 votes so far after
Matt
a couple
and I
of
have
hours.
Talked about this, and we think the draw for Roger Federer is incredibly crucial because he's essentially going in completely cold, isn't he? So he needs a kind few opening rounds to play himself in. I think he's going to be susceptible quite early on. You're looking at me like...
I know
that's not an answer, but we haven't seen the draw.
The idea that Roger Federer, how many times has he won it? 5 times.
Yeah, but he's not won it for 11 years.
The idea that he, having come out of Wimbledon, having had match point against Novak Djokovic, having won 20 Grand Slams, is not in the mix to win the title this year is absurd.
It's ludicrous.
He isn't. I agree. For me, he's in the mix. Mm.
And he is... And if you ask me... and I'm going to ask myself whether he's going to have a better US Open than Daniel Medvedev.
How many of those 600 and whatever people are you?
Well, I find you're
how
only
many
allowed
accounts
the,
do you have,
you're
Dave?
Only allowed the one vote. Actually, for a long time, it was 52-48, which I found very interesting. Now it's 55 Federer, 45 Medvedev. I'd say Federer every time because Medvedev, as wonderfully as he's playing, he's just totally unproven at that level. And he, I don't know what he's going to do over best of five, coming off a run like this. He's never done it before.
He's a builder, I think, Medvedev, isn't he? And the next step from winning a Masters, for him, I don't think is winning a slam. It's doing better at a slam than he has done before. He's never reached a quarterfinal at a slam. Would probably expect him to do that now. That would be a next step for him. But, I mean... I think people are reading way too much into Federer's Cincinnati loss, to be honest.
I mean, to be honest, it's very hard not to end up reading too much into these events.
Well, we've got nothing else to read into, though. That's the problem. If he now had another...
Got 20 years to read into.
If he now had another event to play before the US Open, I wouldn't be worried about him because, you know, it's a week in isolation. What I worry about is him going in cold.
I do agree. I think he needs a kind couple of rounds, but I think... You know, chances are he'll get that. I don't see a huge number of floaters who aren't.
When was the last time he really struggled in early rounds?
Well, it was fourth round against John Millman last year.
No, it was. I mean, I think he's a... And unless something's changed between now and Wimbledon, he's in a way better place than he was a year ago.
I think
physically,
so.
I think mentally, I think
possibly
everything.
Not mentally. There are still question marks about Wimbledon hangover, surely.
And I think he's
62 minutes, David.
I know. I just think, he's going to play best of five set matches early on at the US Open so he can get his eye in. I think the conditions, I would actually think, are something we probably have to consider because of the way he lost last year, the state of him. I mean, I've never seen him.
Get me off the court, didn't he?
He was sweating bullets, and he looked like an old man in that match. So that's the one question mark I would have as well. I think
he's talked about that since they put the roof on Ash. He's not a huge fan of those conditions anymore. It's kind of sticky and hot, and also I think he schedules his year now to peak for Wimbledon. I think he always has, but particularly in the last few years.
But do you remember last year when I interviewed him before the US Open?
He
said the US Open was always the priority this year. Like
Halep at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
That's
interesting.
Dobre.
When did you do that interview?
Media Day US Open last year. He said US, it's been 10 years since I won this one. This was always the target this year.
That's great. Great line.
I mean... He might just have been saying that because he'd lost to Kevin Anderson at Wimbledon and it was a way mentally of trying to get over that, what must have been a very heartbreaking loss. But, yeah, I did find it interesting at the time.
Okay. Well, we'll have lots more of this sort of chat when we do our draw retrospective on Saturday.
Is Medvedev the one of the... I mean, I know he's 23, therefore not next gen, but you know what I mean when I say next gen. Is he... the one you would have going furthest at the US Open?
Probably. I still am such a massive believer in Tsitsipas that I think that he can pull it together, but I think he has just scheduled himself in a way that is starting to hurt him now.
Alexander Zverev, bookies fourth favourites.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I think
the next Bjorn Borg, guys. Don't dismiss the next Bjorn Borg.
Medvedev reminds me of Zverev at the end of last year with that serve and the ground strokes, and it's like he's just suddenly become him.
And Zverev was the last player outside of the big three, big four, to have a run similar to what Medvedev's just had, except he did it last year on the clay in the build-up to Paris. But that never felt like it would be transferable to Paris because you've got Nadal.
Yeah.
Whereas it does, the US Open has been the one where people have kind of muscled in a bit, Cilic, Del Potro, Wawrinka. But by my own definition of the mix, I can't put Medvedev in it.
So your mix is two?
Three. It's the big three.
Oh, it's Federer, sorry,
because
yeah.
Our definition of the mix is you wouldn't be surprised if he won it. I still would be surprised if Medvedev won the US Open. It feels like such a big step still to take. I think he's definitely not next gen, but team, I would still possibly have as potentially doing better than Medvedev. I think
he's done nothing though. I mean, I really, I totally understand when I was in Montreal and I saw the way he spoke about winning in Kitchbull. I mean, I think he's probably still lying in bed at night cuddling that trophy. I mean, it means everything to him winning Kitchbull. I understand why he's played there and played on clay at a 250 after Wimbledon, but I really think that hurts him. I really do, and I don't know how he's gonna. He's obviously never gonna not play Kitchbull. For the greater good of tennis, I wish he wouldn't, but I do understand, but he's done nothing.
I just feel like over the best of five sets, Medvedev could just get bullied out of matches and worn down by a Chorich or someone. People peak at these things.
You know? Medvedev's kind of having the year I thought Chorich might have. Last year I thought Chorich would be the one to kind of step up, especially on hard courts, but he's had a lot of injuries and struggles, but Medvedev has kind of filled that void. I just think team, I back him over five sets physically more than I would probably Medvedev. Well, and I think he quite likes those hard courts.
Well, that's what made me say, David threw out on our Kiri-optimists chat, which has not been Kiri-optimistic this week.
That needs a swift rename.
Who do you think is, did you use the term next gen, David? How did you put it?
I don't think this was me. I think your brother said this.
Oh, did he?
I don't know.
It was you.
Of course it was.
David says so much.
Who would you go with for the next new male Grand Slam champion?
Oh, yeah, I did do that. Yeah.
You did that on Twitter as well.
did you?
I forgot that.
Oh, you're running out of material.
I've got so many polls running around my head at the moment.
And the first name that sprung to my mind was Khachanov. I don't know.
Blimey.
Because of the best of five sets thing, he's the most physically capable,
I'd still go Tsitsipas.
See, I'd go team.
No, he is. Oh, but, sorry.
Is he next gen?
No, next gen was not in the question. So, yes, you're allowed to go to team, yeah.
But the team's only ever going to win the French Open. So, you know, he's just going to keep running into the deck.
That's the problem. But I mean, he won Indian Wells. He can play on a hard court. He knocked Federer off the court.
He needs there to be a Grand Slam after Indian Wells and Miami, though, because I really, I'm just rehashing what I just said. But the run into the US Open doesn't work for him.
Mm.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Let's explain why we're not Curie-optimists anymore. Nick Kyrgios played a match a few nights ago. Who was he playing? He was playing Hatchinov, yeah, and he was set up. He was, I think he went 5-4 up in the second set as well. He had, I think, 4-3 and love 30 at one stage on Hatchinov's serve. Everything was going swimmingly. Now, of course, I mean, Catherine shouldn't really be on this podcast because she declared that she was not going to be on it unless she got to see Kyrgios against Djokovic. And so we're basically waiting for Kyrgios to just, you know, tidy up this final game and set up Djokovic against Kyrgios. Didn't happen. For some reason, Kyrgios started to get annoyed at his perception of when umpire Fergus Murphy was starting the shot clock when he was serving after a serve, and felt Murphy was doing it way too quickly. He didn't get warned for a time violation at this point, but it really rattled him, really got him wound up, and he just started having it out with Fergus Murphy in a one-sided dialogue, which just carried on and carried on and carried on. He ended up losing the second set, Kyrgios. He went off the court saying that he'd gone for a bathroom break, but he didn't go for a bathroom break. He went into the corridor just outside the court and he smashed two rackets into the wall. He then came back with those two broken rackets, threw them on the floor, shouted out into the air, "You're the worst effing ref ever." And other sorts of comments, carried on through this process throughout the next four games, which went to two games all. And then Hatchinov won the last four games in 9 minutes, which probably tells you its own story in terms of those particular facts. As Kyrgios was coming off the court, he shook hands with Hatchinov, walked towards Fergus Murphy and said, "You are an effing tool, bro." You can fill in what word I've left out, and he sort of spat into the air, not onto the umpire, but in his direction. At which point he got given the following day a fine of, I think, $113,000 for six separate offences, I think it was, in the end, several of them being unsportsmanlike conduct. It caused, as per usual, a lot of conversation. Kyrgios has since put up what is actually quite a funny and clever little video showing the time he takes between serves and the shot clock running compared to Nadal. And one of the big gripes he had on the court was that Nadal gets treated differently and that he plays a completely different sport and it's not fair. Thoughts, people?
Oh, so many thoughts. Well, he behaved appallingly, didn't he? He behaved appallingly. He is,
What else is there to say?
What else is there to say? He behaved appallingly. All this, everybody wants to package up their feelings on Nick Kyrgios as a tennis presence into a one-liner. He's good for tennis. He's bad for tennis. He's appalling. He's electrifying. Whatever. He's not. He's all of those things. He can be on aggregate good for tennis and still have elements about him that are terrible for tennis and terrible for him personally. And I mean, I think there are I think there are underlying psychological issues which explain his behaviour, but they don't excuse it. I think he's really troubled. I think he's unable to deal with, I think it's a reaction to winning in Washington and the expectation then that comes with that. I just don't think he can handle anyone in his life having any expectations of him, let alone external people outside of his life. But none of that excuses the way he deals with it and turns it on. It's one thing to tank. It's one thing to smash your rackets and behave childishly. It's another thing to bully somebody, which is what he did to Fergus Murphy out there. Incidentally, not that it's hugely relevant, but I think Fergus Murphy's been one of the most lenient umpires with him over the years. He's always kind of had his back and tried to, you know, within the confines of the rules, I think, but he's not been one of those that's been strictly applying the letter of the law to Nick Kyrgios in a headmasterly kind of way.
I mean, sometimes Fergus is not somebody who's afraid to have a go back at players.
No.
He's done it with a lot of players. And actually with Kyrgios, I've felt that he really has pulled back on that, probably because he knows that it can inflame him.
Yeah, I think he's managed Kyrgios really well over the years. And I think sometimes that can involve going a little bit more gently. But yeah, to see him bully Fergus Murphy the way that he did. And look, I'm sure Fergus Murphy can handle himself and isn't crying himself to sleep over it, but that's not the point. It was nasty and unpleasant and entitled and rightly punishable by the biggest single fine he's had to date. I believe the ATP are considering further sanctions. That's going to be very interesting, because if he were to receive a ban, it would apply to Laver Cup. Laver Cup is now an ATP sanctioned event. Kyrgios is a big deal in Laver Cup. They've already announced him. They've already put his name up in lights. Federer is invested in the Laver Cup. This is when all of these factors and little nuances behind the scenes in the mechanisms of tennis governance come into play. And there's also the fact that a ban won't necessarily have any impact at all. He's been banned before, hasn't he? He was in 2016, I think, he received a suspended ban. It was mandated that he'd have to see a sports psychologist, did all of that. Nothing's changed. Mm. The highs are getting higher and the lows are getting lower, I think.
Yeah, that's well put, actually. And he, when all this was going on, you get the inevitable, is he good for tennis, is he bad for tennis conversation, which I'm just totally bored of, because I don't care. I don't care whether he's good for tennis or not. In that particular moment, he went and abused a man just doing his job to his face. And that was inexcusable. You can come up with anything you like. That is not on. It's not okay. And I found it very interesting to listen to the interview that Andy Murray conducted, in which he's quite happy to say he gets on well with Nick. He sees a lot of things from his perspective. He likes him. He wants the good things for him. But that was not okay, the way he treated Fergus Murphy on that occasion. And he said, in his words, "I did not enjoy watching that third set." And that's exactly how I felt all the way through it. All the feelings of joy that you get from watching Kyrgios above and everybody else, because he has this wonderful gift of connecting with people and doing things that nobody else can do, but he also has a way of depressing you when he behaves like that. And I think the problem that the authorities have is where you can't, I don't feel you can take into account what's the good things he brings to the game when you're adjudicating over something like this. You have to look at the offence, and you can't say to tennis, "Yeah, but he's good for the game in other ways. We can't be doing..." No, you've got to make the right decision, and he needs to, and the people around him need to be able to find a way to get him to be his best self more often in order to handle this, or not. His alternative is to not, and therefore to keep having these incidents or just not be relevant.
And it's so often umpires that kind of get him going. He seems to have a real problem with authority. And, you know, you mentioned that social media post. There's no hint of remorse about him at all. I mean, he had completely bullied Fergus Murphy. And I just imagine now the umpires, I don't know how it works, they get the rota, oh, I'm on Kyrgios. You know, it's like going into work and knowing that you have to deal with this kind of nasty colleague all the time. It must be soul-destroying. And there's not a hint of remorse. He felt wronged. He didn't seem to accept that he'd done anything wrong. But I do think the way that Twitter and social media just explodes whenever something to do with Kyrgios happens, it's almost like tennis can't really handle him, because, as you say, like, so many people want to have a categorical, definitive view on Kyrgios. It's like you hear a lot of people say, oh, you love him or you hate him. I don't feel like that at all. I feel so conflicted about him. And yet you see people on Twitter put out things like, oh, it's fine, it's Kyrgios, he can do what he wants, or it's Kyrgios, he's terrible. People seem to have this black and white view that I don't really get, and I don't think works with someone like Kyrgios. You have to kind of try to understand him. You can't just box him and package him and talk about him in black and white terms.
It's bizarre, isn't it? I wonder if I've been pondering on whether that's a social media thing, whether that would have been the case before social media, or whether it's this whole 142 characters thing encourages us to want to have these easily packageable black and white views about people, because it's just so not applicable to Nick Kyrgios that you end up boxed in a corner that you watch what happened in Washington and you think that's brilliant. That doesn't mean you're not allowed or able to criticise what he did in Cincinnati. How can you not criticise what he did in Cincinnati this week? He spat in the face of a colleague. He spat in the face of a colleague.
I mean, not literally in his face, but in his direction.
Yeah. No, I mean, there is no scenario elsewhere in the world where that would be behaviour that we'd consider defending.
And he might say, well, yeah, I mean, the world we're in, everybody's got an opinion and everybody throws them in. I mean, look, 30 years ago, this would have been big newspaper-type headlines, and he wouldn't necessarily have a clear right to reply the way he does with his 1.2 million Instagram followers. So there are pros and cons in that regard. What was interesting is, in terms of what he does now, in terms of, we've had last year at the US Open his incident with Mohamed Lahiani, which led to Lahiani being laid off matches when Lahiani was viewed as being too sympathetic visually on court and kind of almost talking him through his funk on the court, and that being inappropriate. And then we've had this ESPN documentary about the Serena Williams against the umpire that has just launched over the last 24 hours, and a lot of discussion. I saw an article in the New York Times saying that Serena won't be umpired at the US Open by Carlos Ramos because of that incident. And it got into quite a discussion point about, is it appropriate for players to request that an umpire doesn't do their matches? And how does that system work? I mean, I got into a little bit of a discussion with Rene Stubbs, the former doubles world number one and a very good commentator these days, somebody who's always interesting to listen to. I didn't agree with her on this particular situation. I mean, she said that she'd three times in her career she had requested over the course of 22 years she'd requested that an umpire not do her matches, and that had been granted, and that is absolutely correct in her view. Now I think I think it's fine to ask. I do not think that should be granted personally, because I think that opens a precedent for anybody to say, I've got a problem with an umpire, and where do you draw the line?
My understanding, and this is from a few years ago and not necessarily official, but my understanding was that umpires had a no list, a list of players that they, not necessarily an immovable no list, but a list of players whose matches they wouldn't be put on for whatever reason, not necessarily as requested by the players, just because of previous incidents or aggro or unpleasantness, anything. I didn't realise or think that it was the case that players could just request not to have an umpire on their matches. And I think what strikes me as most uncomfortable about that setup, if that is the case, is that quite obviously there's going to be a power imbalance there. Serena Williams requests not to have a certain umpire on her match, no one's saying no. Rebecca Peterson requests not to have an umpire on her match. It's probably not going to be treated with the same gravitas, and that isn't fair.
Well, I've been in touch with Enrique Molina, who's a former Grand Slam final chair umpire and also head of officiating at the International Tennis Federation for a number of years. These days, he's an agent to people like Feliciano Lopez, somebody we know well. We've had him on the podcast last year, actually after the US Open incident with Serena and Carlos Ramos, and that's still available to listen to if you'd like to listen to Enrique. I asked him, players requesting umpires not to cover their matches, should this be allowed? He said, I know that the ATP in the past allowed that, but I have always tended to disagree. Instead, it is best to enforce the umpire's no list, by which the umpire themselves put down the players that they have had a recent big conflict or issue with. Like that, you will avoid unnecessary controversy right from the start. I asked him whether he'd ever received any, the sort of abuse that Fergus had taken and how he reacted. Because, I mean, I don't think I could stand there and take that. I would have to say something back. I'm not going to be spoken to like that. And I also think, and I'm certainly not trying to have a go at Hatchinov here, but I think if I heard somebody speak to somebody else like that, I would have to intervene. I don't think I could just stand there and ignore that.
But can you
that.
Imagine how dreadfully that would have gone?
Yeah, I understand. I understand. It could go make it inflame the situation, all that sort of thing. I don't think I could stand there and watch that. Enrique said, I only saw bits of the match. I've been in many heated arguments, but don't recall any as such. Sometimes I had fired back to players, but so to speak. He said, normally umpires are trained not to take things personally and on their shoulders. It is a psychological game in the end, where you definitely want to ensure that there is mutual respect and within certain limits. The key is to play one card at a time so the whole situation doesn't blow up. But at the end of the day, if the player decides to go over the line, the code of conduct is there to help. I also asked him about the situation with regards to Carlos Ramos not doing Serena Williams matches and what his thoughts were about that. He said, I'm not sure if Carlos had umpired Serena last year, but I don't think it would be the right place to make a comeback. He should definitely do her matches again, not just because he handled her extremely difficult circumstances well on that day, but also because he is one of the best umpires. But taking into account that there are other top umpires that can do her matches in New York and diffuse any unnecessary drama and controversy, it's probably best that he doesn't do her matches there.
Yeah, because that would be the story, wouldn't it? Mm. And I don't think that's fair on him as much as anything. So that makes sense to me.
He does say that players' views on whether an umpire should do their matches should be heard, and referees should analyse what may have happened in the past. But you know, you can't have players just determining who's umpiring a match. I mean, I'm trying to think, in football, you can't just get a team's manager saying, I don't want that referee doing my match.
I would also say, with Fergus Murphy and Kyrgios' situation, that could have been anyone. He needed that. It's all about Kyrgios, isn't it? He needed something.
Something happened.
He needed something to release the absolute mess of psychology that was happening in his mind and body, and he found the nearest host being on which to project that, and it could have been anybody. It could have been a set of white towels, as it was in, was that in Montreal that he took it out on the white towels? It's all about what's going on inside the unfathomable brain of Nick Kyrgios. I look forward to, you know, him drawing Djokovic first round of the US Open and us talking about how brilliant that's going to be.
He's seeded now.
Oh, yeah.
He's got to win two rounds.
It could happen in round four.
Oh, God, he's going to lose to Guido Pella round one, isn't he?
Oh, it's all happening. Just one quite final thought here. Today is on the subject of Bianca Andreescu, who didn't play Cincinnati, and we actually had a handful of responses from our listeners who weren't happy with our description of her as a drama queen. Quite interesting, and feel that we were a bit too hard on her. I personally don't feel that it was said in a negative fashion. I'd say it with quite an affection, really. I like the fact that she's just not bothered what people think.
We like drama. David likes aggro more than he likes forehands and backhands.
And yet,
we can bestow no greater honour on a player.
But I suppose what we're saying is I must like pantomime aggro, because I didn't enjoy that from Kyrgios the other night.
That was an aggro, though.
That was just nasty.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Aggro is Medvedev being asked what his relationship with Tsitsipas is and saying, there's no relationship.
And then doing that ATP Cards Against Humanity thing together.
Yes, which is great hashtag content. It is really, really great.
I think that demonstrated you give team a chance not to say anything and they will take it.
Well said.
Also in that, the clip of Milos Raonic flossing.
Have
you seen that before?
Yeah, that's his Harlem Shake that he did at the Monte Carlo player party
that
about 10 years ago.
Burned my eyes.
Fantastic.
That's 10 years old?
Well, it's quite a few years old. I quite like sort of dark horse Milos Raonic showing another side to himself.
I can't forget it, and I really want to.
I've got it on my bag if you want to have another watch. It's really good.
Right. Were you present for it or something?
No, I've just kept watching the clip. It's one of those clips, you know, you just get...
Like Nishikori doing that drop in Cincinnati. Do you see that video?
Was that like a bungee jump?
I think it was at Kings Island, the brilliant, brilliant theme park, just across the road from the Lindner Family Tennis Center in Cincinnati. But yeah, it was just Kei Nishikori in some sort of harness... Just there's a countdown, 3, 2, 1. There's a kind of noise, and then suddenly the floor opens and he drops through it.
Oh dear.
Never to be seen again.
Well, until like when he emerged eventually.
There was some symbolism there, I thought, in that video.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
It was amazing.
Poor old Kay. Anyway, he'll be back as part of the draw. Is he in the mix? He's on the boat? Dunno. But he'll be at the US Open.
Kyrgios's new thing, by the way. Is his new Andy Murray is Daniil Medvedev. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah. Best buds.
He blooming loves Daniil Medvedev. So we've got Kyrgios and Tsitsipas used to hate one another, or Kyrgios certainly used to not like Tsitsipas, and now they're best buddies. We've got Kyrgios who... as far as I can tell, it looks like one-way traffic to me, who just is sort of in love with Daniil Medvedev. And then we've got Daniil Medvedev and Stefanos Tsitsipas, who don't get on at all. And we've also got them all on a private jet together from Washington to Montreal.
Oh, the intrigue.
It's
it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's like reality TV.
They're running rings around us, aren't they? We don't know what to think.
Well, even before this week, when we were watching the first round of Montreal with Kyrgios, I was watching it with my wife, and she sort of vaguely watches tennis from afar and listens to what I've got to say about it. And she said, it's like reality TV, isn't it? And that is exactly what it is. But anyway.
Speaking of which, I've got some breaking news for you.
Oh, yeah? What's happening?
Sloane Stephens tweeted 2 minutes ago, after much thought... At Sven Tennis and I, so Sven Grunewald, who is active on Twitter of late, should we say, at Sven Tennis and I have decided to go our separate ways. Change is never easy, but I'm so appreciative of our time together. Onward! !
I wonder what happened to her.
So he's free to take a job on the UN or any other sort of...
All sorts of places.
Peacekeeping... What do you think he might like to do with his free time?
He probably find another
spokesman for fill in the blanks. It's like Cards Against Humanity.
He's been arguing a lot with a lot of people.
Yeah,
about stuff, including me. So that's all right. I quite like Sven. He's all right. Well, we've got another tennis podcast coming your way in a couple of days' time. And it is a big interview with the former coach of several of the best players we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years, Larry Steffanke. And he's somebody I've wanted to interview for years because he was also always so entertaining. As Catherine shows me a picture of Andy Murray having a chat on Twitter. Don't know what that's about, but he looks happy. And in fact, Andy Murray was one of the people that tried to get Larry Stefanke as his coach on two separate occasions, which I asked Larry all about and why he didn't do the job. Also spoke to him about what it was like working with a man that was headlined the most hated man in tennis, a.k.a. Marcelo Rios, when he was world number one, what Yevgeny Kafelnikov was like to coach when he got him to world number one, and Australian Open glory and Olympic glory as well. Andy Roddick, Fernando Gonzalez, John McEnroe, these are all players that Larry Stefanke coached. We talked about all of them, and it's just, I found it to be a great fun interview. Nothing to do with me, it was him. He's just one of those characters that once he starts talking, you know, you just can't stop listening. And that's coming your way, I reckon, on Wednesday afternoon. So keep your eyes open for that. We will then be back with our first of our daily tennis podcasts from Flushing Meadows in New York. Catherine and I will be there. Catherine today announced as the presenter of Amazon Prime Video's coverage in the UK. Over the next couple of weeks. Looking forward to it.
Very much so. Pumped. Mary Carello also on the team.
Yes.
Yeah.
Look at her face lighting up. Mary's on the team, which means we might be able to get another podcast with her. Fantastic. Prime have also got Jan McEnroe, Tim Henman, Martina Navratilova. Fantastic group of former champions, pundits, people that you'll be hearing from if you're in the UK, with Catherine presenting. So that's all good. And we'll have daily podcasts for you after play every single day from the bar, no doubt, when Catherine and I are just sort of picking ourselves up from a day of coverage. I'll be there for BBC Radio 5 Live as well. So we can't wait for that. Have I missed anything else?
Well, Murray, I suppose, but he doesn't play till he plays midnight tonight, doesn't he? First yes. round in Winston-Salem.
That's right.
Is this his first ever trip to Winston-Salem?
I think it probably is.
North Carolina.
Unless he just went there for a
holiday.
An outing.
Tennis Sangren, midnight tonight.
Yes, okay, we'll be watching out for that. We have brought you in association with The Telegraph. We're executive produced by tennisballs.com. Our mascot is Rio with a Y. The rain has stopped, so I'm making a dash for the car before the next storm comes in. Ahead of the US Open, if there's anybody you think might be interested in having a listen to a daily podcast where two or three people talk about tennis every day, let them know.
It's one of the 100 best podcasts in the world.
Yeah.
Officially, sort of.
Yes, according to the Mail on Sunday magazine. What was it? What were we called? 100 podcasts you must hear. Something like that.
Wasn't it most addictive?
Yes, that's what it was. And you're our evidence of that.
Wildly popular.
Yeah. Wildly popular. That's what we were called, yeah.
I'd like that on my headstone, please.
Okay, I'll organise that, except I suspect I'll be going before you. Given my grey hair,
things have just got a bit dark.
It was really, really bleak.
It was like the content Cincinnati did, where they were asking their players, what did you get told off as a kid? And they were all giving really sort of funny answers.
Running through fields of wheat.
And they got to Tsitsipas, and he said, I got in trouble. I was meant to be looking after my brother at the beach, and he disappeared, and they thought he'd been kidnapped. It just suddenly got so dark.
Sorry about this, folks. I didn't realise this is going this direction. Yeah, so more of this stuff every single day throughout the US Open. What more could you want? Download us every day. Tell everybody you know, and we'll speak to you soon.